Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and this is Steven Siegel. I'm your host at New Books in History, and welcome back. I'm coming to you today from the shadows of the Rocky Mountains, and this must be a first on New Books in History, because we're interviewing a historian from the Arctic. So it's my great pleasure today to introduce Bathsheba Dumuth. She is the author of Floating Coast, An Environmental History of the Bering Strait, published just last week, in fact, by Norton and Company. I'm really quite thrilled to have her joining me here today. So Bathsheba Dumuth is Assistant Professor of History and Environment and Society at Brown University. She is an environmental historian who specializes in the lands and seas of the Russian and North American Arctic. She has lived in Arctic communities from Eurasia to Canada, and she has earned her BA and MA from Brown University, and yet another MA, plus a PhD in history from the University of California at Berkeley. Welcome, Bathsheba, today. So let me begin with the story of this book. How did you come to be interested in the topic and spend all of the time that you did with such an amazing set of sources?
So this book really began 2 decades ago now, almost exactly 2 decades ago, actually, when instead of going to undergraduate like a normal 18-year-old, I convinced my parents that I should take a gap year because I didn't know what I wanted to study, and college is long and it's expensive. And so I had mapped out this very ad hoc itinerary at a time when gap years weren't really institutionalized yet. And the first stop on this itinerary was in a little indigenous village in the Canadian Yukon called Old Crow. And my job in this village was to take care of a sled dog team for a local family who I also lived with. And then my plan was that I was going to be in Old Crow for, 4 or 5 months or something like that. And then I was going to go to Costa Rica. And then I had some other spots on my itinerary. And long story short, I have still never been to Costa Rica because I ended up staying in the Yukon for several years. And a large part of why I stayed there was because my I just completely fell in love with being out in the bush and with the kinds of skills that I was learning how to do. It's a mostly subsistence community still. It's about 200 people. It's 100 miles from the nearest road. And I was out, working with this dog team all day, every day, particularly in the winter. And so the kind of learning how to survive in that landscape, learning how to have a relationship with these animals that I depended on, quite literally for my life and in many circumstances, it was pretty hard to let that go. And as I was spending time up there, I also became aware that some of the ways in which I had been taught to understand the way the world works, which is with a really pretty firm separation between what in the academy we call sort of the humanist side of things and then the natural or hard sciences side of things, didn't actually seem all that separate up in the Yukon and in the Arctic, because the environment and that sort of natural sciences part of life is so very present. And so I really left this, you know, 2 years plus that I spent up there with a set of questions about the ways in which humans and the non-human world interact with each other and influence each other based on that experience, which, you know, I didn't articulate it in those terms quite when I started undergrad, but really have been kind of the motivating questions for me ever since, and were certainly the motivating questions by the time I got around to going to grad school.
I have to ask as a first question, because I'm absolutely fascinated by your itinerary going from, I think, Iowa to the Arctic to Russia. It's really hard to follow your steps. How is it that you came to study the Bering Strait as a kind of dual USSR, maybe even Russian imperial history? What is the connection between where you came from and where you end up? And how does that factor into your study of ecosystems, the relationships, as you talk about in the book, between how humans change nature and how the non-human world changes humans?
That's a great question. So there are some intermediary steps between me at 18 on a dog sled and me writing this book. And a big one of those was actually that after I finished college, my husband and I did Peace Corps in the former Soviet Union. So we were in the Republic of Moldova for 2 years. And I was absolutely fascinated when I was there by the kind of remnants of the Soviet Union that were, you know, everywhere and that we were living in, literally. And I remember thinking that, you know, the kind of Soviet development model was both completely familiar in its sort of modernist overtones and absolutely different than, you know, places elsewhere I had been in the world where I had seen kind of these attempts to transform human life on a large scale. And then I realized that if I was interested in the Arctic and I was interested in sort of socialist space, I should probably study Russia because it has a lot of both. And so I decided when I was in Peace Corps to apply to PhD programs in history and in Russian history, having at that time taken exactly zero classes in Russian history, and not actually knowing that environmental history was a field. So I had a lot of catching up to do when I got to grad school. But I started learning Russian when I was in Peace Corps, so that I at least had that piece when I hit the ground in graduate school. And then, so I applied to grad school to be a Russian historian. So I wasn't thinking of myself as an environmental historian at the time, and ended up at Berkeley and worked with Yuri Sluskin, who's sort of the one other person who's really written about Siberia at the, you know, kind of taking graduate student level of training. And while I was kind of starting on that project and in the earliest kind of phases of grad school, so still in coursework, kind of two things happened. One of which is I actually read the first piece of environmental history I had really formally come across, which was Don Worster's Rivers of Empire, which was, you know, 30 years old at the time and absolutely blew the top off my head. And I was like, this is what I want to do. I've sort of finally figured out where all of my kind of questions and obsessions about people and not humans come together. It's kind of amazing that it took me that long to realize that there's a whole field that's dedicated to that, but there you go. And then once I started thinking about the Russian far north in kind of ecological terms, I realized that the part of the Arctic that I was the most familiar with, which is, you know, on the kind of Yukon, Canada, US border, is in this region, which was part of the Russian Empire. The Yukon wasn't part of the Russian Empire, but right across the border was. And so sort of Russia had this influence there, but it's also a place that is ecologically the same kind of across that whole trajectory. So from the Yukon all the way over to the Kolyma River, on the Russian side of the Bering Strait are ecologically really similar. So the nation-state boundary doesn't make an enormous amount of sense if you're thinking about the place in ecological rather than in national history terms. And because I can already speak English, it turns into a project where I could sort of do this comparative thing right across the Bering Strait. And then I became really fascinated by the fact that no one had actually looked at the Bering Strait in these kind of historical terms before, because it's such a kind of amazing natural experiment in what it looks like to be, an American-style capitalist or a Soviet-style socialist, in conditions that are virtually identical, and that are home to the same animal species, that are home to the same indigenous cultures, but then in the course of the 20th century become kind of inhabited by these very different ideological systems. So I figured most of that out while I was in graduate school, and then, sort of proceeded to do research. I did a year of research in the U.S., some of which was in D.C. and some of which was in Alaska and elsewhere, and then a year in Russia, some of which was in Moscow, because all Soviet historians end up in Moscow. Some of it in Vladivostok and in Magadan, and then up in Chukotka itself.
Yeah, and I think I see a great tension between the center and the periphery. I know it's something of a cliche, the whole borderlands thing, but you have in some ways a nation in your story, which is extraordinary. Maybe even a cosmic world of Beringians, as you call them. And I wonder if you might talk a little bit, not just about the political records that everyone really has to gather, local, regional, national records from the U.S. and in Moscow, as you mentioned. But how did you go about collecting oral knowledge, these centuries of wisdom, which I think are really adaptable to change among the Yupik and the Inupiat and the Chukchi populations? Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. That's a great question. So there's a quote on the side of the Brown English department that's from Gertrude Stein that says, "Then there is using everything," which is kind of how I feel about my methodological approach to writing about the Bering Strait, which is it's a very large geographical space with a relatively small number of people in it at any given time. So you end up using kind of any possible source that you can get your hands on that talks about this particular place. And one of the richest sources is the histories that people within the Bering Strait have of themselves and have been telling for themselves and to themselves, for, in some cases, millennia. And so I tried in the course of this to use those sources as much as I possibly could as a kind of counterpoint, and in some ways a corrective, depending on the situation, to what was in the kind of more traditional Soviet and Imperial Russian and American bureaucratic records. And I was very fortunate in that many communities in the Bering Strait have had kind of formal oral history projects, or have worked often starting, early in the 20th century with anthropologists to record kind of a whole variety of histories. So most oral societies, and those in the Bering Strait are included in this, differentiate between histories of things that are sort of so far back in time that they have kind of a quasi-mythical aspect to them, and things that are kind of within historical time where people kind of can name the generations, they know the individual people, they know when things happened, not necessarily in the sense of having a calendar date, but they know how many generations back it was, they know where events took place. And so there have been these quite remarkable and really important projects to record those oral histories that were foundational to this book. And I couldn't have written it in this form without them. And I also thought it was important to use those oral histories because those are works that these communities, and there are many communities in this book, so, 10 on the U.S. side of the Bering Strait, roughly, and 10 on the Russian side, these are works that the communities have decided to put out for the public themselves. So they're kind of representing their own histories to the world. And because I'm working in a really large geographical area and can't go spend, you know, a year or two in each of these communities to really get a sense for what kinds of history they want made public and what kinds of history they want private, I felt much more comfortable using kind of the versions that the communities themselves have chosen to make official over time. And they're really, you know, rich, complicated, fascinating documents. And I think one of the things that was not surprising to me, because I had spent very formative years amongst Gwich'in people in the Canadian Arctic, and was quite aware of how sophisticated and precise oral knowledge is. People who haven't necessarily spent a lot of time around cultures that transmit their intellectual patrimony that way, it is surprising the degree to which things that somebody tells you in an oral form are very much, you know, you can find examples or find overlaps with them in the Soviet record or the American one if you are really trying to kind of wrestle it into a particular date and time.
Right.
So they're really quite subtle.
Yeah, and I'm actually really struck by the multiple voices in your story. So it's never just black and white, and that's something that really impresses me. So, for example, if you have a very literalist reading of missionaries bring God, booze, literacy, disease, sugar, and often no particular order. And, you know, on the other hand, again, not to have a crude bifurcation, but you have witnesses to these projects by people who watch very carefully how foreigners, and you are one coming in, are failing at civilization. It's actually a phrase I think you use at one point, failing at civilization. So could you talk a little bit about those histories of encounters, maybe even the promises that are made and occasionally don't work?
Yeah, and I'm really glad to hear you say that it doesn't feel black and white, because I think that one of the challenges with this kind of a comparative project is either it looking black and white in the kind of, well, the U.S. did everything better than the Soviet Union sense, or vice versa, or you know, everything that was done by foreigners was terrible and nefarious. And then, you know, by saying that, you kind of inadvertently romanticize, you know, Beringians, and sort of reduce their agency by doing that. So I'm glad to hear that it didn't read that way, because it was a thing that I was really concerned about in writing it, that it not turn into, you know, some sort of screed on one side or the other, because I think the story is much more complex, as all histories are. And now I'm afraid I have completely lost the train of your question.
Yeah, no, it's okay. I was wondering if you could talk about these civilizational projects.
Yeah, so part of what fascinated me about looking at American capitalism and Soviet socialism in the Bering Strait is that I had one of those really rare epiphanies you have as a historian in the archives, because usually, at least for me, the archives are a place of, you know, finding small revelations, but not necessarily large structural insights into what you're doing, because you're just sort of churning through lots of material and trying to make sense of it. But I realized at some point when I had been in the archives for over a year that what I was witnessing for both the Americans and for the Russians and then the Soviets was kind of an attempt to come to the Arctic in order to extract energy from it and put that energy into kind of human use, sort of to use in some ways that would kind of better civilization. And that both projects really had that as kind of a core impulse. But then, of course, their visions for what society should be after that are very different. And that the you know, capitalist version is much more concerned with kind of ideas of liberty that are disconnected from the state in some ideal form, although rarely in practice. And then the Soviet version is interested in kind of a much more radical vision of liberty, where there's sort of such material plenty that everybody is able to prosper and can therefore kind of reach their personal enlightenment within a collective society. So I was really interested in, so if, if you need to extract energy from a place that doesn't have a lot, right? It's not a place that's going to have agriculture. It's a place that's really difficult for industry. And those are kind of the two core pillars of both, you know, capitalist development and of socialist development. You need to have the Industrial Revolution and you need to have the Agricultural Revolution. How does this work in a place that doesn't have those things easily, at least? And what happens when you put them under that kind of environmental pressure, essentially? And what I found is that in some cases, they end up, you know, these two projects end up looking like each other. And in some cases, they end up being sort of the most extreme divergent versions of each other. And that has a lot to do with the ways in which, you know, the foreigners coming in are able to actually manipulate the environment around them or not. And sometimes they're more dependent on the environment than their ideologies necessarily would intimate. And then sometimes they're actually able to really kind of carry out their particular goals in a place. But the result of that is that the actual implementation of the kind of ideal versions of society that foreigners come in with are highly variable. And if you happen to be Beringian and you're sort of on the receiving end of all this, they can be, you know, somewhere between helpful and, you know, completely disastrous, depending on the particular time and place.
Right. Right. So I want to switch a little bit now. We've been talking too much about humans. And your book is an excursion into the non-human world. So you mentioned energy, and I never would have thought of that as a way to describe modernity. I think typically when I'm dealing with the modern or hyper-modern Stalin 1930s, I think about profit and production and the cult of productivity. But I think one thing I really learned from your book is the necessity of studying plants and animals, their sounds, their cadences, their songs. I know you mentioned Moby Dick and some Jack London, but the idea of listening to the ice or hearing the sounds of the whales, can you talk a little bit about how you integrate the non-human into this larger environmental story and sort of polyvocal history of the Bering Strait? How does that happen?
Yeah, that's another example of a place where I felt like I was using every possible kind of source and a set of sources that aren't necessarily traditional for historians, although I think more common amongst environmental historians, which is quite a bit of natural science. Quite a bit of actual just observation, depending on the species of animals that I've spent quite a bit of time with or places or environments that I've been able to observe over time. And then quite a bit of it, and I think, in fact, the entire orientation toward paying attention to the kind of agented nature of the world around us comes from the way in which Beringians, you know, the Chukchi and the Inupiat and the Yupik understand the world that they live in. And this was also true of my host family, my Gwich'in host family in the Canadian Arctic, that the kind of hard line that I had grown up drawing between subjects and objects and humans and not humans was much, much more plastic. And certainly the idea that humans alone have agency is just like a laughable concept if you spend very much time in the Arctic, because often you are very, very aware that your agency is quite small and of very little import in terms of whether or not you're going to make it through a given day. So I think in a lot of ways, and I didn't even realize this as I was writing it, it's actually taken kind of completing the book and then talking about it with people, that my whole orientation toward it came from living there, not from a particular theoretical kind of school. It was really trying to represent when trying to communicate to people something of what it feels like to actually inhabit that place over time. And it does feel polyvocal, and some of the things vocalizing aren't people. But to get that on a page, I did a lot of research in kind of animal behavior and ecology, and used a lot of science. And so historians of science might raise their eyebrows at this, because I'm definitely not a historian of science. I'm a historian who uses science, and I think those are two really different things. But I also felt for kind of both reasons of empirical accuracy and my kind of ethical concerns that trying to communicate the capacities and actions of non-animal beings was, or non-human beings, was really critical to the history I was trying to tell. And then to do that, some of the best tools we have are coming from natural scientists. And some of the best tools we have are coming from the, you know, the intellectual traditions that have been living with and observing and imagining these non-human beings for thousands of years. So some of it comes very much from indigenous perspectives and understandings of the Bering Strait.
Yeah. I wonder if I might add something to that as a, sort of a follow-up. I was really struck by your descriptions of whalers and the whaling industry and the industrialization of that process. But not just whales, also walruses, caribou, reindeer, Arctic foxes. How do they write history?
I mean, I think one way, and the easiest way to see how non-human animals write history is the ways in which they bump into to people, and so they leave a trace in the archive. And so I certainly used lots of those. Another way that they certainly try to write their own histories is by changing their behaviors in response to people. And you can see this very clearly with the bowhead whales that, you know, kind of clearly change the way in which they interact with the kind of tall ship Moby Dick style whalers that come from New England in the middle of the 19th century. And, you know, kind of develop a set of adaptations to try to mitigate the kind of killing force of those ships, and are successful for a couple of years in the 1850s before the whalers figure out kind of workarounds. And so I think that's a way in which the whales are writing their own history, right? They're very much trying to kind of preserve right. space for themselves to continue their culture. And culture is not my word. It's actually a word that's used right. by Hal Whitehead and some other cetacean biologists. I don't think as a historian I would actually feel comfortable using that word unless I had had somebody coming from the natural sciences. But there's a lot of people working in animal behavior that are starting to think about animal emotion in addition to animal cognition and animal culture, in addition to just sort of social behavior. And whales are one of the places yes. where that's really rich. But you can see it in wolves and in foxes and in walruses also, that are the animals that seem like they're communicating ways of being and ways of managing the landscapes that they're living in between generations, and not just through genetic transmission. So I think that's one way in which kind of animals are sort of writing their own histories. It's also possible that whales are singing about it. Who knows? I wish we could translate what they're talking about.
Right. Hum, trill. I think you have marvelous descriptions. Hum, trill, honk, rasp, groan. I'm sure I'm missing something.
Yeah, no, they're amazing. And, you know, some of these animals, some of the bowheads live for two centuries. So I wish I could interview them. It would be great.
Yeah. And actually, that was something I wanted to ask, because you do talk about cetacean bodies and how whales choose to die. This is a fascinating thing. I had thought about it a little bit in relation to buffaloes. After all, I live in Colorado. But how does that happen? And maybe even how did you notice this? Because as a historian, it seems incredibly important given the dependency on the environment and the fact that you yourself in traveling there are trying to learn not how to die. This is a big theme in your book, I think.
Yeah. So that the idea that an animal that you're hunting gives itself, rather than it being sort of a question of conquering it, or, you know, the kind of narrative that comes from sort of elite European aristocratic hunting traditions that have then in various ways kind of disseminated into American mainstream hunting society, is much more common in many indigenous societies, and including those in the Bering Strait. And particularly with whales, it emerges from a set of observations of particular behaviors on the part of bowheads, which Yupik and Inupiaq hunters have observed the ways in which, you know, whales will surface, you know, near a whaleboat, and sometimes will kind of hang out around a whaleboat, and sometimes do this for an hour or more, but will always be outside of the harpooner's range. So you're not physically able to kill it. You move your whaleboat, the whaleboat moves the whale. And so there's kind of this dance back and forth. And then at some point, the whale will either dive and just kind of disappear, move off, or the whale will surface on the side of the whaleboat next to the person holding the harpoon. So it's usually on the right-hand side of the boat. And some of these hunters will describe how whales will even come up and touch, you know, they'll kind of knock into the left-hand side of the boat. So they're really close, and they're obviously observing what's going on in some way. And the understanding of this for Yupik and Inupiaq hunters is that what the whales are doing is kind of assessing whether or not the people who are out there hunting them are worthy of dying for. And so that the kind of the act of the whale dying is a gift to the community and is a gift to hunters whose kind of moral comportment has been such that they're worthy, which is, of course, a really different way of understanding the relationship between yourself and an animal that you have to kill in order to eat, than one in which you're, you know, trying to kill as many as possible in order to make a wage, or one that you're trying to kill as many as possible in order to meet the Soviet quota, or kind of whatever those other systems might bring in. So some of what I was trying to do contrasts the ways in which, you know, societies that have for a very, very long time required living off the death of other animals. And in the Arctic, this is unescapable because you cannot become a vegetarian. Right. I mean, you could now. You'd have to fly in all your food and it would be very expensive and you'd burn a lot of fossil fuels. But historically, it hasn't even been an option. So how, you know, what is the kind of ethical corpus that has developed around societies that understand themselves to be dependent on these animals rather than understanding those animals as a resource that you just take from until perhaps there are no more out there to harvest?
Yeah, and I think back to the politics for a moment, you mentioned the dueling consciousnesses, I'm not sure that's the right word, but consciousness by both markets and plans. Markets in the sense of American or US capitalist rapacity, I'm not sure what to call it, but plans also in the sense of Soviet five-year plans and tallies and quotas, and especially in the context of harvesting, I think those quotas or tallies become something almost profane, more than Dickens' Satanic Mills or you know, Dostoevsky's Notes from Underground. I wonder if you might talk about that consciousness, because it seems to relate to the energy that you're describing as the essence of politics or the harnessing of energy.
Yeah, and that was, I think, one of the things that I found really illuminating about being able to look at the United States and the Soviet Union in parallel with each other and rather than in isolation, and not in parallel in kind of a Cold War sense. Like, they're not openly in competition. It's not a diplomatic story for the most part. It's just one of kind of what do these two systems look like operationally, is that the degree to which they're very much both based on kind of ideas of endless growth. And obviously, if you kind of dig into the sort of granular history of either capitalism or socialism, there's lots of debate about how much growth and when growth and, you know, how much is too much, perhaps. But, you know, at the end of the day, the way of assessing the health of a society, and you can hear it on the news every night, is what is the NASDAQ doing? Is the GDP going up? And of course, the Soviet Union had its own version of that, which was kind of this accelerated planning where, you know, if last year we killed 372 whales, well, that means next year we can kill, you know, 480 whales. Right. If you kill 520 right. whales, that's even better. And that, you know, kind of both of them are sort of using their capacity to pull in energy and other resources as the bottom line for assessing the health of a society. When, you know, that's just a value judgment, right? There's lots of ways of assessing whether or not a society is truly healthy and people within it are leading meaningful lives. And some of that, of course, is going to require having access to sufficient material life to build houses and do things like that. But it kind of goes beyond that, I think, for both the capitalist and socialist systems in this case, and becomes growth for its own sake. And one of the things I found really interesting is that the US style capitalism, it wants overall growth in the Arctic, but is completely happy to have kind of the locus of that growth move around. So, one year it might be coming from foxes because they're very in vogue and everyone's wearing fox stoles in the 1920s. And then, the next year that might completely disappear. And there's sort of no concern on the part of the society as a whole to really look after the people and the places that get left behind when the market just moves on. Whereas the sort of socialist emphasis, which, you can kind of see it coming from this desire to make everyone equal, also wants to make every space in the Soviet Union kind of the equal level of extractive capacity kind of come out of it. And that actually makes the two look kind of different in practice. And I think it makes the Soviet Union's kind of appetites toward parts of the Arctic move more quickly. It's not that the capitalism isn't just as rapacious. It's sort of more, it moves around more. And the Soviet system is really concerned about sort of making reindeer maximally productive and whales maximally productive and doing both of them simultaneously.
Was there a point in time when the sort of Soviet ecological consciousness changed? And this is my way of exiting from the industrial conversation about industrial modernity and maybe utilitarianism. There's kind of a high water mark for the territorialized sovereign state. Charles Meyer talks about this, the Harvard historian, from roughly the 1840s to maybe the 1970s. Is there a change that happens somewhere? Is it Rachel Carson who inaugurates the change, or Amnesty International? How does it work among the communities that you've been studying?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think there is, you can see certainly in the United States by the late 1960s and 1970s, a kind of sense of a global or extra state concern with the environment. And you see elements of that in the Soviet Union also. One of the most interesting things I found is that for some particular resources within the Soviet Union, and particularly for walruses and some other Arctic mammals that I actually don't talk about in the book, like polar bears, that consciousness kind of came before that wave of global environmental concern. It's kind of bolstered by it by the end of the 1950s when, after Stalin has died, and it becomes a lot easier for scientists to move internationally, and they start to realize that they're in dialogue with people, elsewhere in the Arctic and elsewhere in the world who are concerned about species loss and potential extinction and things like that. But it seems like, in the Soviet case, as in the American case, there is a capacity for people to recognize their activities as destructive and to sort of turn the values of the system that they're within to actually address that. And I was really relieved, honestly, to find at least one case where that's really clearly what happened, because it, it means that these aren't just kind of ideological dead ends where we're completely stuck with one way of thinking that's so inflexible and so total that we cannot imagine relationships with walruses or any other kind of resource that is slightly more amenable to, the lives of those other animals or other spaces or ecologies. So I think that, yes, there is that realization in the Soviet Union. There is that realization in the United States. And to me, there's actually something almost more honest about the way that the Soviet Union confronted environmental damage, in that they didn't have the capacity.
It's my next question.
The United States sort of gets an environmental consciousness at the end of the 1960s and into the 1970s, and passes all of this really wonderful legislation that we should fight for absolutely. And it's now actually quite imperiled, so we should really fight for it, like the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act. These are great things. But it also happens at the moment when the U.S. is deindustrializing and moving its kind of manufacturing bases outside of the United States. So all of that nasty pollution becomes someone else's problem, while American consumption just goes up and up and up. So it really decouples the kind of costs of production from the capacity to consume it. And I think that the Soviet Union, just for most of its industries, doesn't do that. Their citizens are really living with what it looks like to have a kind of massively industrialized economy that's moving toward providing more consumer goods over time. Obviously less in the Soviet case than in the American one, but and I think that that, you know, some of the work done by other historians and not by me, looking at the ways in which dissatisfaction with pollution within the Soviet Union is kind of a contributing factor to the ways in which people think about the kind of failures of the system, is something that the U.S. just doesn't have to confront.
Yeah, and actually, I think my question is also about the records that you found in the collections by especially Russian and Soviet ethnographers. So, you know, on the one hand, you've got anthropologists and ethnographers. On the other, you have the establishment scientists who are researching climatology and oceanography and other things. Maybe could you talk a little bit about those records in the collections and especially the ethnographic work? Did that enable you to develop certain characters in the story? How did you do that? I know you feature a lot of them.
Yeah, sure. So particularly on the Russian side, there's an ethnographer who was active there. He was an exile during the Tsarist period named Valdemar Bogoraz, who spent a lot of time with the Chukchi and then is kind of foundational in the creation of the Committee of the North, which is this kind of group that's formed in the late 20s and then kind of into the 1930s is in charge of developing the, you know, quote, small peoples of the Russian Arctic. And so his work with Chukchi people is extremely detailed. His book called The Chukchi is, I think it's like 800 pages long. And so that was a really critical piece of kind of understanding the late 19th, early 20th century. But then Bogoraz himself is kind of a character because he's there at this really transitional moment, kind of moving out of the Tsarist period. He has, you know, obviously not a lot of buy-in with the Tsars, given that he's exiled to Chukotka for his beliefs, but he's also not a Bolshevik entirely, but he kind of gets, you know, interested in the Bolshevik project. Oh, wow. Because he sees it as something that can really kind of sort of do the things that the Tsarist system was failing to do in Chukotka, which is, you know, bring schools and bring hospitals and, you know, kind of consistent services like that. So he ends up being a figure just because he's really kind of in a fascinating position. And, you know, by the middle of the 1930s, he has a very kind of gradual approach to how he imagines the sort of socialist missionizing in Chukotka. And, you know, by 1935, 36, you know, gradualism is really kind of on the wane. And, you know, he kind of lives through that whole cycle of the early purges. He's not actually purged, but so figures like that were really important to trying to have some, you know, not just whales talking, but also some people who really came through.
And as far as the environment of commodification went, since you mentioned the purges, can you talk about what happened to the shamans, for example, the traditions of shamanism? So you did mention that some of them had been victims of the purges. Can you tell us about the significance of that?
Yeah, there's kind of two trajectories in the ways, you know, to generalize quite a bit, in the ways in which collectivization and the purges look in Chukotka. And it kind of breaks down along geographical lines. So there are Yupik and Chukchi people who live along the coast and have kind of more or less settled communities. There's some moving around, but much closely to stationary communities and hunt sea mammals. And then there are Chukchi people who live in the interior of Chukotka who are fully dependent on reindeer, domestic reindeer. And collectivization along the coast tended to be relatively peaceful. in large part, I think, because most Yupik and Chukchi communities on the coast were essentially collectivist to begin with. So what the Soviets were asking for, you know, sharing what you've hunted amongst each other, you know, those kind of things, was not a huge imposition. And then it's clear that some Yupik became really, you know, staunch Bolshevik believers. One of the sources I have is an autobiography, you know, written by a young man who becomes a full-on Bolshevik, does a lot of work kind of working in communities to convince his fellow Yupik men and women to become part of this project. And he sees it in this autobiography in very kind of concrete terms. It's, you know, the Soviets say that if we build the collective farm, we will have access to the tools that make hunting better. And if we can hunt better, then we won't go hungry in the winter. You know, it's actually kind of a caloric interpretation of what the Soviet Union can provide, that this young man, Malo, was kind of taking from what the Soviets were saying. And this is really different than what happens out on the tundra amongst the Chukchi, the reindeer herders, who own their reindeer as private property, and were really disinterested in handing over their reindeer to collective farms. Disinterested to the point that some of them would kill their reindeer rather than do it, or would commit suicide rather than participate, or in kind of open armed rebellion with the Soviet state for decades. Actually, in some ways, I think this piece of Chukotka is sort of the last place to become Soviet, and it doesn't really happen until after the Second World War. And part of what's at stake there is kind of the religious practices of, you know, both Yupik and Inupiaq people, and whether, or Yupik and Chukchi people, and whether or not you can do it in public, whether or not it's sort of recognized. And obviously, the Soviet state is not interested in shamanism being, you know, kind of a public piece of how people conduct themselves. So people who were openly practicing shamans started to face, you know, penalties. And in the Chukchi communities were arrested and imprisoned pretty frequently.
Okay. So I've been leading you with way too many leading questions. And now I wanted to ask you about Beringia and the sort of larger world. You say at one point that the contradiction of existing in Beringia is that in order to live, something, some being is always dying. So could you talk about Beringia as a local place and maybe Beringia as an ecosystem and a planetary place? What is it that we can learn about the inescapability of lifespans and life cycles from the area across the international borderline?
So maybe where I should have started in terms of talking about the place in general. I think Brinji is interesting because it seems, on the one hand, to be, you know, as W.H. Auden called it, altogether elsewhere. Like, you know, it's up there, it's frozen, it's distant, it's far away. But I think that the ways in which Beringian ecosystems operate, and actually the role of the Beringian ecosystem globally, mean that it's not altogether elsewhere, and that there are pieces of it that are very present and that we can learn a lot by paying attention to. I think the place that we can learn something is because in Beringia, the land is significantly less biologically productive than in a temperate zone. So it's much harder for plants to turn sunlight into tissue because it's cold, because there's permafrost in the soil, because of the ways in which there are, you know, long summers, but then no light during the winter. This means that there's sort of less energy available on land. And this also means that all of the kind of adaptations of humans and other animals and other organisms generally is on a slightly finer margin, right? The difference between, you know, a good year and a bad year is really slight in the Arctic, and particularly on the Arctic land. So, you know, a half a degree warming for reindeer can be extremely difficult in a way that is not necessarily the same in a temperate location. So I think part of it is that the Arctic just gives you these relationships in really stark relief, and particularly the ways in which the kind of cyclical patterns of population growth and decline amongst animal populations and plant communities intersect with human ones, because those margins are fine enough that you can kind of isolate particular factors. So that for me as an environmental historian was really useful about this place.
And are you working on another Arctic project right now, or the far north, or Siberia, or anything like that? What is it that you're working on now?
So right now, as of like 2 weeks ago, so it's very new. What I'm working on is a history of the Yukon River watershed. And in some ways, it's a project that goes back to my interest in comparing things, because the Yukon River watershed, it's like the third largest river system in North America. So it's quite vast. And it cuts through a whole different set of indigenous homelands. And then in the 18th and 19th century is kind of cut between the Russian Empire and the British Empire. And then in the 20th century becomes kind of a borderland between the United States and Canada. But all along this system that ecologically speaking is quite shared and kind of refers back and forth. So you can see my interests kind of continuing in doing the comparative thing. But what I'm really interested in along this kind of watershed and through the last 250 years or so is the ways in which people's ideas about rights, and particularly legal rights for and to non-human things, so rights to timber, rights to control certain kinds of animal populations, rights to water, and things like that, have kind of changed and played out and layered on top of each other, because they're really different ideas about, you know, what rights nature has, right? Are they only ever given by people? Are they intrinsic? And rights isn't even the word that many indigenous societies would use, and they have other kind of ways of imagining the future orientation and the moral capacities and the kind of need to being that non-human things have. It also means that I get to go back to kind of my old stomping grounds in the Yukon. So that's not a small piece of my interest here, because I have, you know, two decades of ties with parts of the Yukon watershed.
We've been speaking with Bathsheba DeMuth, professor of history at Brown University, and she is the author of Floating Coast, an environmental history of the Bering Strait, published by Norton this year. Let me thank you, Bathsheba, for joining us today on the New Books Network.
Thank you so much, Stephen.